Download complete in 3, 2, 1. News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010.
See, ball.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, mama.
Good evening. My name is Errol Brusnap. Welcome, listeners, to the Big Stick here in Toronto, around the world via the Surfer Network or Windows Media Player on the World Wide Web and on 6070 kilohertz in the 49 meter band shortwave. To Strange Days, indeed. The 127th program about the increasingly intriguing phenomena of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight on Strange Days, indeed, a daylight video of a UFO over Nevada, a French flying triangle near Paris, a dazzling UFO seen by two in Caguas, Puerto Rico, and Shag Harbor's post office issues a UFO stamp. Those and other stories tonight, along with the regular contributors Dave Fermat, Richard Hall, featured guest Palmiro Campagna, the UFO watchdog Royce J. Myers, and Victor Vigiani. And of course, as usual, we want you to join us on the phones at 416-872-1010, 1-800-561-CFRB, or Star Talk. This is program 127 about these strange days indeed. Here on News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010.
Meetings, deadlines, Rover has to go to the vet. The kids have ballet and piano lessons, a last-minute project. And you still have to find time for mealtimes. Instead of driving by the takeout window, visit Bruno's takeout counter for a wide selection of fully prepared items from their hot counter. Chicken, ribs, grilled veggies, potatoes, pasta, and more. Plus salad and fixins from the deli counter. Or stock up on Bruno's fully prepared hors d'oeuvres and entrees. Like Bruno's own 5-pound family-sized lasagna, just $12.99 each. And Bruno's Scottish smoked salmon, previously frozen, just $18.99 a pound. You can serve a hearty, satisfying meal the whole family will love, even on the busiest days. Just visit Bruno's Fine Foods, because behind the Bruno's name, there really is a Bruno.
7 locations, including 1560 Yonge at St. Clair in Delisle Court and Royal York at Dundas in Etobicoke.
Unidentified French flying triangle. Yeah. Oh, well, it's the last day of the month. We're moments away from the 1st of April. Strange Days indeed is the program. My name is Errol Brusnap, and the program tonight, well, it features Dave Fermat, Richard Hall, our guest at 11, Palmiro Campagna, the UFO watchdog Royce J. Myers got his teeth sunk into something or other tonight, and we'll be hearing what. And Victor Vigiani. And you can get involved at any time. The email address is sdi@cfrb.com. That's sdi@cfrb.com. That's the sound of the email window being open. I like that. That's better than a bell. You can also call in. Yes, yes, you can. 416-872-1010, 1-800-561-CFRB, or Star Talk. And I know that you like to save your calls till about 6 minutes to one. That's okay. Just remember the numbers. 416-872-1010, 1-800-561-CFRB, or Star Talk. And that is Star 8255. Enough of the intros. Let's get things rolling with the latest. Now, he's going to blame me for that. That's Graham on the other side of the glass. He happens to have that in the can, too, on the computer. That's highly handy. Yeah, you get Johnny upset with me. That'd be nice, won't it? Please. It's a great night for talk radio. That's what it is. Casey Holt and two of his friends had sightings on Monday, March 5th. They saw two bright spherical or oval-shaped objects seen during the day at about 2:30 in the afternoon, drifting slowly from the northeast to the northwest over Laughlin, Nevada. Now, the objects seem quite high, they say, but lower than the clouds and at about 60 degrees up and about 1/16th the size of the diameter of the moon. And one object appeared to flash red, blue, and dark, dark and white. Okay, well, if dark is a color, and rotated in a counterclockwise direction around the more stationary, bright, white, or silvery reflective object. Casey and his friends watched the two objects for a little over 10 minutes, during which about 90 seconds of video was taken of the brighter white object. And the video is in the process of being analyzed. Isn't it? Don't we hear that story almost every week? Somebody shot some video somewhere. Do you ever see it?
Nah.
Jonathan Dunford wrote to Filer's Files this past week that he's an expatriate who's living in Paris. He's been there for 16 years. He's an amateur ufologist. His French wife has tolerated his interest in the UFO phenomena, but has always been skeptical. On the night of March 26th at around 10:15 in the evening, and that's only 5 days ago, I guess that's, Monday evening, returning in their car from Orléans to Paris near Antony, not far from Orly Airport, they were driving on the highway when they noticed, off the right shoulder to the right, three white lights in a triangular shape, with a red one, somewhat larger, in the middle. That's a familiar story, too. The light in the middle was red and surrounding ones white. He was driving, so he didn't get a chance to look hard at it, he said. His wife immediately opened the car window and noticed the massive structure that at first she thought was sitting on a pole. Then this thing disappeared suddenly and with no noise into the fog that surrounded them. It was a classic flying triangle experience. Jonathan Dunford was so thrilled that because he studies the subject with much passion, but had never witnessed a UFO in the flesh. His wife, who never even really wanted to talk about UFOs, now knows that they exist, although he says she's convinced that and thought that this object must have been terrestrial and some sort of sophisticated military project. Jonathan Dunford told George Filer that he'd like to know if any of the many cars on the highway reported the incident. And anybody who's listening to the sound of my voice on the highway near Antony between Orly Airport and Paris, listening live on the web in their car, yeah. Jonathan Dunford wants to hear from you. Joe Trainer reported this week that on Monday, March 12th at around 2 a.m., two men spotted a dazzling UFO near the intersection of Routes 1 and 172 in Caguas in Puerto Rico. Two male witnesses, named as Serrano and Leon, were sitting on a porch in the Barrio Beatriz of Caguas. I think that's how you pronounce that. Facing an intersection when they saw a bright light heading toward them from the mountains near Aguas Buenas and over Highway 1. The object's brightness increased as it approached them. It flew at a low altitude over a farm located some 15 meters or 50 feet away. I have trouble visualizing that. A farm 15 feet away. From where the witnesses sat, it was flying from north to south and then vanished over a nearby hill. The witnesses didn't notice any unusual smells related to the event, but report that the sighting left an odd taste in their mouths, kind of like holding a battery between one's lips, which is all right if you don't hold the ends with your lips, because it gives you funny tingles. They also heard an almost imperceptible buzzing sound, like that of bees, which accompanied the event. And strangest of all, Saran and Leon saw that the object appeared to have something like luminous mirrors clinging to the bottom section, which appeared to rotate. They estimate that the size of the object was 10 meters or 33 feet in length. The men complained that the UFO was so bright that it was painful to look at, and they couldn't make out any definite shape. Thanks to Orlando Pla, Lucy Guzman, Scott Corrales, and Joe Trainer's UFO Roundup for this report. The distinguished researcher, Dr. Richard Haynes, a distinguished UFO researcher, too, formerly of NASA, has, with Ted Rowe, recently helped to establish a new national organization called NARCAP, N-A-R-C-A-P. NARCAP is singular among world organizations in providing a completely confidential center where pilots, air traffic controllers, and radar operators can report their sightings of anomalous phenomena which threaten aviation safety. These reports can be made confidentially by telephone and the Internet. NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, is staffed by technical specialists who, in contrast to current civilian and government institutions, will not endanger air safety by either skewing or suppressing the reports. These specialists tentatively include Joel Bartlett, who's a meteorologist, Captain Neil Daniels, a pilot, Susan Dreisky, a information and technology and technology and sciences person, James McCampbell, who's an engineering physics man, and we all know Jim McCampbell, at least those of us in the field do, James E. McClanahan, who's air traffic control, FAA regulations, Brian E. Smith into aerodynamics, Willie Smith, into physics and UFO field investigations, and Robert Stahl, a flight instructor and accident investigation and systems engineering. An interesting lineup of people. Dr. Haynes said in his press release that to, quote, based on a comprehensive review of past U.S. pilot radar operator and controller reports, NARCAP believe that there's a potential and ongoing threat to aviation safety posed by so-called anomalous aerial phenomena. NARCAP would like to work with the nation's airlines to implement special pilot training classes directly relating to coping with such close encounters in the air. End of quote from Dick Haynes. If you need any more information, you can contact Ted Rowe. He's the executive director of NARCAP, N-A-R-C-A-P. Post Office Box 140, Boulder Creek, California, 95006. NARCAP, Post Office Box 140, Boulder Creek, California, 95006. And thanks to George Filer of Filer's Files for that story. In the past few weeks, you've heard us mention Shag Harbor and the Shag Harbor incident and Don Ledger's book, A Dark Object, the Shag Harbor incident. Interesting story on the wires this week. Les Perot, writing in the National Post, reports that residents of Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, will be mailing an image of a flying saucer with every letter and package after Canada Post approved a new postmark commemorating a visit 34 years ago by an unidentified flying object. Wow, isn't that interesting? You know, I went down in Roswell back in 97, and there's the United States Air Force denying that anything ever happened in Roswell, and there's a mobile United States Post Office selling commemoratives at the 50th anniversary of the Roswell crash. Very interesting. One government department denies, another government department cashes in. Nice envelopes, nice stamps. Let's motor out to Markham, shall we? And our regular correspondent out there, author, online author, author of a couple of e-books now, Dave Furlott joins us. Dave, good evening.
Good evening, Errol.
How goes it, Dave?
Well, it goes pretty good.
It's got to be at least 20 minutes since we last talked.
Oh, yes, I think so.
So what you been looking at this week, Dave?
Well, here's what we've got. You can progress forward or you can fall behind, but you can never stand still for very long. Now, particularly here in Canada, when it comes to UFOs, we have stood still for too long. But that is about to end, because we are at the dawning of a movement to bring Canada forward in a way that will show the world what can happen when citizens and government move together towards a common goal. We live in a time when the thought of extraterrestrial life is taken for granted. We're indulged with movies, books, television programs that feed us stories about different races spread throughout the universe and how we will interact with them in the future when we are capable of throwing off the chains that bind us to our planet and can take to the stars to search out new life and new civilizations. We take all this in and we're quick to point out that it is all science fiction. However, we should also remember that it wasn't too long ago that the idea of a submarine or the concept of breathing underwater as presented to us by Jules Verne was incredible science fiction when it was published. Consider for a moment that we finally get a chance to explore the universe, and when we come across another civilization on a distant planet, is there any doubt that we would take every opportunity we can to study that planet and its civilization? Of course we would. So why is it so hard for us to imagine that a civilization that has already learned how to easily move through space would not do exactly the same thing? Based loosely upon the premise that we are being visited by curious beings from other worlds, and also based upon the belief that the Canadian government might have some information to substantiate the former, we have put together a group of people whose goal is to help Canada come forward as a proud country to bravely show the world all that we know or think we know about UFOs. The concept here is to educate the government representatives, make them understand that we are concerned citizens that speak for a greater silent group, that are concerned about some of the strange things that appear in Canadian skies. In doing this, we hope our concerns and our questions will be voiced in the House of Commons. We hope to get enough of a voice so that the government will allow a group of us to gather and share information with all the citizens of Canada and further with the world. We want Canada to take the step forward and show the world that as a country, we are dedicated to finding the truth behind the UFO phenomena. I believe that Canada is poised and the time is now for this to happen. And this time, that's not just my take on it.
No, and it's something that's going to spread out all over the place in the next few months. It's going to be some interesting times, and we'll just keep you appraised, you the listener, of what it is that we have in mind as time goes by. If you listen to this program on a regular basis in the next little while, you'll be privy to all of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Get involved.
Mm-hmm.
We need all the involvement.
Yes. This is one of our regular correspondents, ufological observer, author, and teacher, Dave Furlott, ladies and gentlemen. Dave.
Oh, well, thank you.
Nicely done. So, have you been tap dancing this week?
Oh, a little bit here and there.
Yeah?
How about you?
Yeah. Some interesting things coming down the wire. It turns out that the initiative that Jenny Randall's started up on UFO Updates, my email list, a couple of weeks back, is an April Fool's joke.
Yes. Well, of course, I mean, it is that time of year, isn't it?
Yeah. I found it hugely amusing.
And the silly thing is, it shouldn't be an April Fool's joke, though.
No.
Because, I mean, it does make a lot of sense.
Well, it'll be interesting to hear what Dick Haynes has to say about that in a few minutes.
Yes.
Because he's been pushing for some sort of a coalition of UFO researchers that we can stop all the bickering and backbiting and flame wars and get down to some serious stuff.
Exactly.
The politics of dancing and ufology exists, too.
Oh yeah, I mean that is the situation where we do have the politics ongoing. Now the trick is now that we understand some of the politics, we have to work with the politicians in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And we have to get them moving.
And we shall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we will get ourselves moving in that direction toward the education of members of parliament from all across the country.
Exactly.
And just to let them know what we know and what we think we know in one form or another. And perhaps we'll have all of that together for the fall session of Parliament?
Yes, the fall session of Parliament, which I believe is starting in September. I've got to get the exact date on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a situation we want to get that out to them, all 301 members.
Yes. And all of this has come about as the result of a program, the Best Canadian UFO Evidence, which we did a couple of weeks ago here, where we had researchers and seriously interested parties from all across the country, from sea to shining sea and down to Albuquerque, which is where Stan Friedman was from his home in Fredericton.
Hopefully Stan is back home now.
Yes, he is. I just got an email from him. He's back off the road. He said he had 1,015 messages to read. And most of them were from UFO updates. That amuses me a lot. He answered the one that I had sent everybody before that program 2 weeks ago. So it'll be a few days before we hear anything serious from Stanton T. Friedman. Dave, thank you very much for your input tonight.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Good as always. Is your book out there at vangoch.com yet?
Yes.
It's up.
It's up there.
Good. That's two e-books, huh?
Yeah, that's two. And it's also, I'm pushing to try and get this one as well into print.
Well,
so
I'll keep you advised. I wish you luck. I don't know about the listeners, but... good luck with it, Dave.
No probs.
Yeah, this is Dave Furlott, ladies and gentlemen. Two e-books at www.vangoch.com. Go take a look. Good night, Dave. Thanks.
Good night, Dave.
Joining the ranks of regular contributors to this program is a legend in the serious study of UFO phenomena and a well-respected researcher among his peers. Richard Hall is a former assistant director and acting director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, and consultant to the University of Colorado UFO Project, which was sponsored by the Air Force Office of Scientific Research. Richard is a former editor of the MUFON Journal and past chairman of UFO Research Coalition, UFORC. Richard's UFO-related publications include a 1968 Encyclopedia Britannica Book of the Year article. In 1998, he published published Uninvited Guests, a documented history of UFO sightings, alien encounters, and cover-ups. And then just this past month or so, the UFO Evidence Volume 2, a 30-year report. It covers 30 years of UFO sightings since 1964 with related data and descriptive features organized by category. Richard Hall. I've done that three times this evening, Dick, and I apologize. I was reading a story on Dick Haynes and NARCAP, and I'm... I'm embarrassing myself now. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening.
How goes it, Richard?
Okay, I don't mind being called Dick Haynes. He's a good guy.
No, I didn't think you would, but it's just confusing for the listener, you know, when I set up Richard Haynes and Richard Hall shows up. It confuses me, too. So what kind of a couple of weeks have you had since we last talked?
Oh, I've been... very busy. I've been very active on the UFO update.
Well, yeah, right? I was about to mention that, but I was going to add that to everything else that you've been doing lately, because you have been a busy man.
Yes.
I don't know what you have in mind to discuss, but I really liked your debunker's guidebook, first draft that you posted to UFO updates.
I thought
today.
I'd have a little fun with them. I think their debunking falls into very clear-cut patterns. I've dealt with it for decades. I've seen it over and over. They never say a single thing original. And I think it just needs to be exposed and put out there explicitly. And I'm very, very eager to hear what response it brings from them.
Mm-hmm. If any.
If any, yes.
Yeah, well, perhaps over on James Easton's list, they might have one or two things to say about it, since most of the skeptics seem to have moved over there recently. Leaves us a little more room to breathe. Did you read Jenny Randall's message about her UFO council being an April Fool's gag?
No.
Oh, you haven't read that?
No, being what? An April Fool's game?
An April Fool's gag.
Gag? No.
Yep. That's what she posted to UFO updates just a few hours ago.
Oh, well, I missed that. No, I hope she's. I hope she doesn't really mean that.
I have a terrible feeling she does.
Well,
I'm sorry to spring it on you on the radio.
Yeah. Well, I'll take a look at that and think about it. I have a lot of respect for Jenny, and I don't know why she would. It would seem totally out of character to me, for her to do such a thing as a joke. I think clearly it's a very good idea to try to get some kind of consensus among at least serious-minded people on this subject, whether they be pro or con, to decide, you know, what mm-hmm. what the best evidence is. So.
Well, there's been some fairly intense discussion over the last, 14 days about this UFO council that Jenny Randles, who's a British author of many UFO books, she had proposed that a UFO council could come together, and it seems to have gone the way of the dodo.
Well, I think maybe since she got such a negative reaction from a lot of people on all sides of the issue, but particularly on the skeptical side of it, she may have decided it was a bad thing to do. I don't know, but I'll read that with very great interest.
It seems to me that it might be an idea for someone to gather the email addresses of the seriously interested and quietly behind the scenes go ahead and do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, without the public discussion, because no matter what you say in public, somebody's going to come down on you about, you know, crossing the T's or dotting the I's.
Yeah. But what the whole idea of it is to, my understanding of it is to decide amongst ourselves what is the best evidence that will most persuade, I guess, scientists, science, whatever,
mm-hmm.
important people to take a hard look at this situation and reconsider the whole thing. Well, there are other approaches to that. I've been skeptical all along that would ever work, primarily because of the intransigence of the skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine them cooperating in such an endeavor because their minds tend to be all made up, you know, and they're not willing to look at evidence, really. And that's why I parodied them a little bit myself in my debunker's guide here. But, you know, we can proceed with this on our own. We don't need to have the debunkers. Now you get into these semantical issues, debunkers, scoffers, skeptics, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that caught your interest?
I've been so busy on so many things that, you know, I just go in and respond one-on-one on what I see on there particularly, but I don't pay much attention to some of the secondary threads that are going on. I'm totally bored by the alien autopsy.
Oh, yeah, that's just going on and on and on and on forever. For those of you who have been living in a cave a few years back, an English... I guess a promoter of some kind claimed to have found film footage of an autopsy allegedly performed on an alien, and purportedly dating back to 1947 in Roswell. Well, you can imagine the furor that caused when word of it first broke, and then everybody got a look at it and laughed very loudly. But there are still those out there who firmly believe in this film that it really is an autopsy.
Yes, I obtained early on, I don't even remember any longer where I got it from, but I got an unedited version of the tape,
mm-hmm.
and I played it over and over and over and looked at it very closely, and I soon began to realize that the part of it that was not generally broadcast that had to do with a more distant sort of dark, shady-looking scene of an alleged alien body under a tent or something. It was mm-hmm. it was a loop. It kept playing over and over and over. It was just totally unconvincing.
But Santilli, the man who came up with that that footage, I mean, must have just made a fortune off it.
Yes. Well, that's part of the skepticism. I talked to some people associated with the people in the United States who broadcast it or were pitched to by Santilli
mm-hmm.
and so forth and looked at it privately, and boy were they very skeptical of it. You know, they had a good solid analyst look at it, and they just thought it was the biggest joke ever.
Well, I have friends in the special effects world, and they pretty much did the same thing. You know, they sat and howled, basically.
It's one of those sideshows that goes on in this field all too often, and as you well know, my determined focus is on serious, hardcore facts and serious cases and trying to get it out there for serious scientific attention. I'm very determined about that, and I will continue to maintain that focus.
Mm-hmm. Do you hold out, are you optimistic about the possibilities of getting science to finally take a good, long, and serious look at a lot of this stuff?
Well, my one-word answer is no, but I spent a lot of time, a lot of years of my life on this, and I'm not about to give up now. I'm very exasperated by all these distractions that come along and secondary issues that keep overriding it when the real focus should be on what we've been trying to get it on with this council idea.
Namely,
the hardcore, serious, factual cases, the physical evidence, the radar, the, you know, this is where it ought to be. Do we or don't we have visitors? Well, everybody, some of the people on the list are fond of saying, well, everybody has an opinion, and what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything unless we get a real scientific study. And I'm very determined about that, and that's where I'm at, and that's where I will continue to be.
I haven't heard, and I don't know if you've heard anything, any sort of feedback on the book that University of Kansas Press put out, that David Jacobs edited, UFOs and Abductions?
Yes, it's quite a good book. I've read it.
Yeah, me too. But
very shortly.
I haven't heard anything about it since we had Dave Jacobs and Mike Briggs, the senior editor there.
I just read today. I thought it was on UFO Updates. Maybe not, but that it had gotten some kind of review, a major review, and. Can't remember the name of the journal now. It sounded like an important, positive review.
Oh, that's good. No, it wasn't on Updates. I would have brought that in with me. But
yeah. So anyway, it's one of those things that, number one, it's sort of almost unprecedented for a university press to do this kind of book.
Very.
And number two, it was extremely well done, and they had a good cast of authors in there that did an excellent overview of the entire subject, and it's well worth everybody's attention for sure. And if that's the kind of book that could help bridge the gap, the credibility gap, whatever you want to call it, with science, I can well understand the skepticism of scientists. I mean, the whole subject looks quite silly from the viewpoint of an outsider who is not familiar with the serious evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this squabbling and silly game playing and side issues, and you know, it looks absolutely silly. So I understand their skepticism, and that again is one of the reasons why I keep focusing on the factual evidence for UFOs.
Richard posted the first draft of his debunker's guidebook, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but nonetheless bears a lot of truth in it. How to debunk UFOs and discredit UFO proponents. 1. Point out that very large percentages of things reported as UFOs turn out to have conventional explanations. Don't talk about individual observers' varying abilities or how believers screen and investigate cases. Always refer to them as UFO believers or ETH believers, implying that their position is faith-based. That bothers me a lot. The press use that expression a lot, believers.
Yes, I resent that. I get called that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But
and it's not, I mean, for me, it's not a case of belief. It's a case of no, because I know what I've seen.
Yeah, it's also a case of analyzing factual data and reasoning and theorizing about it, which has nothing to do with belief necessarily. So anyway, all those things I suggested in that draft have pretty much actually been posted by the debunkers on Updates and everywhere else and have been for decades, as I said. They just keep repeating these same things, and you can't make a dent in them.
Yeah.
You point out that they're doing these same tired, old, trite arguments, and it doesn't seem to make any impression on them whatsoever. They're not even aware they're doing it. That's why I hope maybe this approach would... they can take another look at their approach to the whole thing.
So, Richard says, how to debunk UFOs and discredit UFO proponents. Number three, argue that any given case could have something conventional, and we will never know because we never have all the facts, but don't acknowledge that well-qualified observers have reported unexplained craft-like objects displaying extraordinary performance, totaling in the hundreds and even thousands. And a corollary to that, point number four, avoid any mention of the patterns of appearance and behavior in unexplained cases worldwide for many decades. And this is the stance that we get all the time.
Yes.
Focus on the well-known problems and limitations of human perception, but never mention that people are incarcerated on the basis of eyewitness testimony, that our court systems could not function without it, and that if human perception were as inadequate as claimed, nobody would dare to cross a busy street or fly an airplane. Good points, Dick. Dick Hall, The Debunker's Guidebook. Number six, comment regularly on human credibility or credulity and wishful thinking in a desire for saviors from space. Just don't mention that it applies only to cultists on the fringes of ufology, nor that close encounter cases typically scare the pants off a witness rather than inspire them. Yeah.
They sound familiar, don't they?
Yes, they do. I mean, you've gathered it all together really nicely. And point number seven, always act as if no one before you has really conducted a thorough investigation in a classic UFO case so that it's only a matter of time and diligence before the answers will be found. But avoid mentioning that the suggested answers you propose either have already been found wanting or fail to account for the salient features of the case.
You know who that's directed at? A lot of those Brit pundits over there who keep debunking...
across the water from
classic
here.
Classic cases.
Psychop. Yeah, the so-called scientific study of claims of the paranormal. I have to wonder how much science those people have actually done in the last many years. And a Stan Friedman always says it's investigation by proclamation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
this is why I think they avoid getting involved in this council idea. They don't want to take on individual cases, and when they do, they go through this tired old routine.
It's Kenneth Arnold's or pelicans, or, you know, I mean, it was just patently ridiculous stuff.
The girl was a hot air balloon, and
mm-hmm.
this kind of thing, and which epitomizes the exact thing I'm talking about here. These cases were thoroughly, thoroughly investigated at the time, and, you know, these explanations just don't hold up at all under scrutiny, but they keep repeating them and keep, you know, repetition rather than reasoned argument.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to put this up at your website, Richard?
Well, maybe.
That would
I'm going to wait for some more feedback and make another draft or two of it.
Well, I would just put it up and change it as a draft. Oh, do you change it yourself, or do you have somebody do it for you?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. I
mm-hmm.
think maybe I should, because it does sort of distill the
essence of it.
The problem mm-hmm. that I've encountered over the years.
Richard Hall's website, www.hallrichard.com. That's www.hallrichard.com. Take a trip. Just surf on over there and take a look. Interesting stuff out there. We are just about out of time, Richard.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. And I look forward to the next time.
All right.
And perhaps you will have another draft and we can go over it again.
Well, I'm always glad to take time to skewer the skeptics. That's I get a little pleasure out of that.
Well, as they do get an immense amount of pleasure out of attempting to skewer us.
Or taunt us, as one of them put it, in a private posting that I happen to see. They like to taunt us.
Oh, taunt. Yeah, well, that's kind of like John Cleese up in the castle tower in what was it, the Monty Python and the Holy Grail? the French taunter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fetchez la vache. Richard, thank you very much.
Okay.
And do keep it up. It's lovely to have you out there and on our side.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
Richard Hall. Go see his site, www.hallrichard.com. There was an item that I just wanted to cover off here because we're kind of jammed tonight. We did the Shag Harbor thing. That's not a postage stamp. That's a franking stamp that Shag Harbor, the post office, is going to be putting on. Envelopes coming out of there commemorating the crash of the UFO off the coast of Nova Scotia. And we know it was a UFO because the Mounties were there and they saw it. So, well, I mean, we don't know it was a UFO. Well, it was a UFO because it was for a moment or three, it was an unidentified flying object. And then for a moment, it was a floating object. And then it was an unidentified submerged object. Doubt. Alfred Weber wrote recently to UFO Updates, my email list, that Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project press conference will be at the National Press Club early in this coming May. The exact date will be announced shortly. A major prestigious PR firm will be handling press. Both Steve Bassett and Alfred Weber will be participating in Stephen Greer's Disclosure Process events in May. That's what Alfred Weber wrote. Jan Aldrich of Project 1947 responded, "Interestingly, we're going to have a media event where some people are going to come and tell us some war stories about when they were in the service or worked for the government. But some of these tales are far out and without support doesn't seem to bother the organizers. One radar operator tells us that he tracked a UFO in one sweep across his radar screen. How did he know that? A pip appears on one side of the screen, and in the next sweep, a blip appears on the other side of the screen. How does one determine that the two blips are one and the same? Now, if you can arrange for UFOs to be at your beck and call, why do we need a press conference at all? In fact, why don't we have incontrovertible proof of UFOs? All you have to do is wave your high-powered flashlight, overpriced, special alien-attracting flashlights, toward the skies. And dang things will come, just like calling dogs." This is Jan Aldrich writing. "Now, I'm sure that for the first time that you vectored in on a UFO, it might have been a shock, so you might have left the cameras, videos, and scientific junk in the car. However," addressing Stephen Greer, "now that you can do it almost at will and you can get students, read marks, to come to training camps and do the same, we should have a broad spectrum of scientific data about UFOs from all the times they were whistled down. Enough data that even the greatest doubting Thomases would be convinced. We don't. We have pictures of happy faces with high-powered lights and pictures of indistinct lights in the sky." And he continues on in that vein. I don't think Jan Aldrich has a lot of time for Dr. Stephen Greer and that crowd that is going to give a press conference in Washington, D.C. Joining us from his home in Ottawa is Palmiro Campagna. Palmiro works for the Department of National Defense in Ottawa. He's acted as the Canadian rep to NATO in the area of electromagnetics in military aircraft. He's the author of the UFO files, The Canadian Connection Exposed, and Storms of Controversy, The Secret Avro Arrow Files Revealed. And on the line with us from his home in Ottawa is Palmiro Campagna. Good evening. Welcome back to the program, Palmiro. Hello.
I'm here.
Oh, you are there.
Is it coming through?
Yeah, now it is.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I think it was just open and you weren't sure whether you were supposed to leap in or not.
Oh, it could be.
Well, welcome back to the program. An interesting couple of weeks since we talked here on the Best Canadian UFO Evidence Program. Unfortunately, it was that we didn't have a lot of time for anybody that night. It kind of whipped by with, yeah. I don't know, I guess there were about 14 or 15 of us involved in that. Some interesting's been going on. I think Mike Woods had asked you a question which we didn't I don't recall whether it was we didn't have the time to get to the answer, or you weren't sure about it, or somebody else leapt in and we got sidetracked. But I think it was whether Smith, Wilbert Smith, had met Sarbacher. Perhaps we should actually start out by setting up, telling people who have no idea who Wilbert Brockhaus Smith is, who he is or was.
Yes, Wilbert Smith was an engineer who worked with the Department of Transport back in the 1940s, 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing research in communications, electromagnetics, ionospheric measurements for radio broadcasting purposes. But he also had an interest in what he called geomagnetics, geomagnetic energy, and that was, for lack of a better term, anti-gravity, using the Earth's magnetic field to propel vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So he had an interest in the flying saucer issue. He had read some books on the subject wherein they talked about the possibility that these things operated under those principles. Now, he worked closely with a fellow with the Defense Research Board, the chairman of the Defense Research Board in Canada. That was Dr. Armand Solant. And Solant had a connection in the United States. His counterpart, Dr. Vannevar Bush, a prominent scientist who, as it's been said, was one of the scientists supposedly working on a crashed saucer, a crashed disc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wilbert Smith was put in touch with a fellow by the name of Dr. Robert Sarbacher. Sarbacher was a consultant to the same group that Vannevar Bush was in charge of. And Sarbacher's connection here is that he was also involved in propulsion, missile propulsion, that sort of thing. So what ended up happening is the two individuals exchanged information. And the question was, well, did they actually meet? And the reason for the question, I think, stems from some of the documentation that that we have. Now, on the one hand, Smith wrote a memorandum to his department dated November 21st, 1950, where he said that he had made discreet inquiries through the Canadian Embassy staff in Washington, D.C., and that they were able to obtain for him certain information. And that information included the fact that, yes, flying saucers exist, that the matter was the most highly classified subject in the United States, rating higher even than the H-bomb, and that it was being worked on by a small group of individuals headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Subsequent to this memo, we have Smith's handwritten notes, and these notes are in his writing. These were written prior to this memo. This was September the 15th. Now, in those notes, he says, at the very top, he writes, notes on interview through Lieutenant Commander Bremner with Dr. Robert Sarbacher. Now, Bremner was the military defense liaison person in the embassy, also connected with the Defense Research Board. So the question was, well, did he talk to Bremner and Bremner talked to Sarbacher and got the information, or what? Well, at the end of these notes, Smith writes, the above is written out from memory following the interview. I have tried to keep it as nearly verbatim as possible. Now, when you read the interview, he's structured it as he is asking the question, Wilbert Smith, and Robert Sarbacher is doing the answering. And it's all written in the first person. I'll give you an example where Smith says, is there any way in which I can get more information, particularly as it might fit in with our own work? And he's referring to this geomagnetic energy. And Robert Sarbacher answers, I suppose you could be cleared through your own department, and I'm pretty sure arrangements could be made to exchange information. So it's written in that first-person context. To me, it indicates that Smith was talking to Sarbacher and then wrote the notes up after that particular interview, and not through the intermediary.
Now, this was when?
This was in September of 1950.
1950.
That's right. And then subsequent to that, he wrote in November, a couple of months later, his own memorandum back to his department, wherein he requested that they set up an official group to study the subject and continue on with his work in geomagnetic energy and work with the Defense Research Board on that.
Study the subject being flying saucers?
The flying saucers, mm-hmm, and geomagnetic energy and their method of propulsion.
So here we have a Canadian scientist ostensibly a radio engineer, but certainly interested in geomagnetics.
Yeah.
And anti-gravity.
Right.
Under the auspices of a Canadian government department, presumably.
That's correct.
Which was what, the National Research Council?
It was the Department of Transport.
Okay.
At the time.
At the time.
Yeah.
Under the auspices of the Department of Transport, who's actually checking out flying saucers now.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And of course, the Canadian government never had any interest in flying saucers.
Well, the Canadian government, interestingly enough, a couple of months again prior to this September meeting, which was earlier on in April of 1950, the Minister of National Defense at the time asked the Chairman of the Defense Research Board, the same Dr. Solant, to gather together the members of the Joint Intelligence Council, that was the Army, Navy, and Air Force, with the idea of setting up a group that would study, that would actively study and research and investigate the matters of, and he termed it, flying saucers passing over Canada, or the occurrence of flying saucers passing over Canada. So there was an interest, and Solant was supposed to set up this group, and here we are a few months later, through the auspices of the military attaché in the embassy in Washington, Wilbert Smith gets put in touch with Sarbacher exactly on this matter of flying saucers, and is told that, yes, they do exist. So it's rather interesting stuff. What makes it, again, even a little bit more interesting is that when the minister made this request in April of 1950, just prior to that, the United States government had released their official report on the subject of UFOs. It was the Project Grudge report, I believe, wherein they said that the whole matter was nonsense, hallucination, misinterpretation of known phenomena, misidentification of aircraft. In other words, they debunked the whole subject. So even in the face of that report, you have our minister, I guess, ignoring that and saying, no, I want our own investigation into this. Question being, what did he know that maybe he wasn't being told publicly?
Mm.
And that's where we get in the connection with Dr. Solant and Dr. Vannevar Bush, where Bush is the one implicated in having been involved in the actual investigation of a retrieved crashed saucer. If Solant was aware of that, then the meeting with between Smith and Sarbacher makes that much more sense.
Yeah.
I know it's a convoluted
thing. Well, yeah, it is a convoluted thing, and that's why I asked you to go over it again, because I know we have a lot of regular listeners who perhaps didn't grab it the first time around.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about is basically two governments who deny that anything is going on
publicly,
who are behind the scenes, it seems, from the evidence that you've gathered together under the Access to Information Act. We're collaborating on research into UFOs or flying saucers back then, and anti-gravitics.
Yeah, that's correct.
Interesting that Wilbert Smith was down there in the United States attending a North American radio broadcasting conference in Washington, D.C.?
That's correct.
In 1950?
1950, yeah.
And while he was there, made inquiries through the Canadian embassy staff.
Yes.
About UFOs, and apparently the staff were able to tell him that, A, the matter of UFOs is the most highly classified subject in the U.S., rating higher than the H-bomb, that UFOs exist, that their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush, and that the entire matter is considered by U.S. authorities to be of tremendous significance. Now, a lot of people tried to track down the names of the, or track down the Canadian embassy staff who might have told Smith this, and I don't think anybody met with any success, did they?
Well, Lieutenant Commander Bremner was one of the individuals.
Mm.
There was another fellow there by the name of Arnold Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T,
mm-hmm.
and another fellow by the name of Gordon Cox.
Are those people still around, do you know?
No, as far as I know, they passed away some time ago.
Mm, so, and there's nothing in their, there's no legacy from them to confirm this.
I haven't had any luck trying to track down any personal files from Wright or Gordon Cox, although there are a couple of additional memoranda that we do have, and if I can just make reference to them.
Sure.
Smith, when he, after the November meeting, he was able to set up a project called Project Magnet, which he was going to use to investigate this geomagnetic energy, as well as investigate UFO reports. And in January of 1951, he wrote to Gordon Cox back at the embassy, and he said that he wanted to bring him up to date on the Magnet program, indicated that they had now three engineers working full-time on the program with two technicians, and that they were getting full cooperation from the Defense Research Board and the National Research Council, and filled him in on some of the details of how the work was progressing. Gordon Cox wrote back to Smith, thanking him for his letter, and then basically said that he and the others were, he said, we are, of course, keeping our ears and eyes open if anything does develop, and you will probably hear through the Wright and Solant channel. So obviously, Oman Solant and this Arnold Wright were in communication on the subject. Then he says, on the ambassador's instruction, no one in the embassy apart from Wright and myself is to discuss the matter with anyone. And he says something else about being able to get additional information if he needed it through Lieutenant Commander Bremner. So there's the group, and it looks like the ambassador at the time was also knowledgeable of the subject. And that was Ambassador Hume Wrong. I looked into his files, but again, I was not able to find any reference to the meetings.
So,
so there's a lot of talk going on, but not much being written.
Well, yeah, and the work that Smith did, are any are those files classified? The findings that he came to, or are they available? Are there any files?
Well, there are a number of files available. There was the Project Magnet report, a summary report, which is certainly available. I'm trying to recall back if the full report is there or not. I believe I do recall seeing it, but there is a problem with the files in that when you go and look at them, you ask for Project Magnet. There was another Project Magnet going on at the time, which was a U.S. Naval research thing. That was going on. So it's happened in the past where people have asked for the Project Magnet files, and they've been told, oh, there's nothing there about Canada. It's all American underwater research stuff. But in fact, that file really has nothing to do with Smith or this episode. The Smith information, the little that is there, is in some of the National Research Council records, what's called Record Group 77. And I think I've got all the references to where people can find those records. You'll also find information on his reports in the University of Ottawa library. They were donated by another researcher, Arthur Bray, who I guess was one of the first to really look into the Smith matter in detail, and was actually the one who brought forward the handwritten notes of the meeting with Sarbacher. I believe that was back in the late 70s, early 80s, somewhere in there. I'm not exactly sure of this.
Yeah, unfortunately, Art's very much retired now.
Yes, he is.
I talked to him a couple of weeks ago, and he just he said, it's all at the University of
That's
Ottawa.
Correct.
If you want to know anything, go look.
That's about it, yeah. And so I went and looked. And therein is the information that we have.
Palmiro, the man who calls this program fairly regularly from Waterloo, is on the 1-800 line with us. Micah, good evening, and welcome back to Strange Days Indeed on CFRB 1010.
Thank you very much. The show has been phenomenal the last few weeks.
Yeah, well, I thought the last 126 weeks were pretty
good. No, even more so lately. yeah, my question was, I'd heard that Dr. Sarbacher made the statement that Dr. John von Neumann had been involved.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you had any more information on that, or if that was pretty much...
No. What happened, Sarbacher wrote a letter to another researcher back in 1983, I believe, and he was asked by that researcher if Vannevar Bush was one of the members, and he said yes, and John von Neumann as well. And in that same letter, by the way, he did acknowledge that he had met with this Canadian back in 1950, but there's a little more confusion here because he says he met with Dr. Brenner, trying to recall the name. Well, it was Bremner. Bremner was not a doctor. If anyone could be called a doctor, it would have been Smith, as Dr. Smith. So again, he met with somebody, and I think it was Smith, although he called him Brenner. But anyways, on the John von Neumann thing, I haven't seen any more on that.
Okay. I thought you'd know if anybody would.
I'm still looking.
Okay. He'll know eventually, I have the feeling.
I hope so.
I'd like to throw in a little more confusion here if I can. I mentioned that Dr. Salant was supposed to set up a committee to investigate flying saucers on the go-ahead of the Minister of National Defense. And from some of the other documents that are in the DND files, there's reference to the fact that they did do that, and they did some investigations and some research in 1950-51, but there's no record of those investigations at all. What you do end up finding, of course, and which everybody I think is familiar with, is the formation of what was called Project Second Story in May of 1952, mm-hmm. where Salant gathered the members of the Joint Intelligence Council, along with Dr. Peter Millman from the what was then the Dominion Observatory, and Smith was a member of that panel or that group, and they collectively attempted to investigate flying saucers, or as some would say, apart from Smith, of course, attempted to debunk the whole subject of flying saucers.
Right.
But it's the work that went on before the formation of the Project Second Story Committee that's missing.
Mm-hmm. Micah, thank you for your call. Always good questions. Need to pick up another one here, Palmiro. This is John. Welcome to Strange Days Indeed on CFRB 1010. John.
Hi, Earl. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Hi, Palmiro.
Yes, hi.
Now, you were Dr. Wilbur Smith.
Yes.
Hadn't he set up a compound outside of Ottawa somewhere?
Yes.
Using some type of sensors, and he had had a huge signature of something that had gone by?
That's right. It was in Shirley's Bay, which is just west of Ottawa. That was set up, I believe it was 1953, again with the assistance of the Defense Research Board, which is interesting. I mean, here's a guy that's supposed to be a crackpot in the eyes of some, and yet he was being supported quite a bit by a fairly senior scientist in Canada, which was Dr. Salant. They gave him the this little shack, for lack of a better term, out in Shirley's Bay. He set it up with various instruments that he got, some from the DRB, some from the University of Toronto, instruments to measure magnetic disturbances, instruments to measure ionospheric disturbances, gamma ray detectors, that sort of thing. His hope was to be able to detect the presence of a UFO should one pass overhead using some of these instruments. And I believe it was August the 4th of 1954, there was a detection made of something. One of the instruments recorded a strong signature that there was some massive object in the sky above.
Except you couldn't see it because
right.
It was a real cloudy day.
He went out, and there's the clouds.
Mm.
You know, it's the typical Fox Mulder scenario.
Yes.
You're so close but so far all the time. So nothing was seen. The incident was reported. He went public with that. And that led to, I guess, some embarrassment on the part of the Department of Transport, because here was one of their engineers, as we said before, a government group studying flying saucers. Their take on it was that if the Defense Research Board wanted the matter studied, that D&D should study the subject themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted Smith to get out of it. They didn't like the fact that he had gone public with some pronouncements about the reality of extraterrestrials, and they basically shut him down. Salant initially claimed that he didn't know anything about this research station, but then later admitted that they, in fact, were the ones that had supplied the building to Smith.
Hmm.
So in a public statement before Parliament, Smith ended up actually saying that they had received nil responses to the work that they were doing, when, in fact, they had made this recording back in, I think it was August the 8th.
Well, has anyone else ever come up with, like in the private sector, come forth with evidence using sensors employing different wavelengths, you know, like you mentioned gamma ray detectors, X-rays,
yep.
aside from the radar? Not.
Not that I'm aware of. At least I haven't heard it. I mean, there may be some other researchers out there that have set similar instruments up, but I haven't heard of any, at least in Canada. If they're listening, come forward now. It would be a good time.
Thanks for your call, John.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Good night. Yeah. So my next question was going to be, was anybody else working on this kind of the project that we're aware of? And I guess the answer is no.
In terms of detecting UFOs?
Mm-hmm.
I would hesitate to say no, because we don't really know for sure.
Yeah.
We know of Smith's work. As far as geomagnetic stuff is concerned, or the anti-gravity business, there were a lot of folks working on that aspect of propulsion systems. And I can draw the attention of the listeners to, I don't know if they've heard of a magazine called Jane's Defense Weekly,
mm-hmm.
which is quite a prominent book in the magazine in the defense industry. And in their July issue of last year, they had quite an extensive article called Electrogravitics, the Positive Approach, and they have a photograph which they think was taken in the late 1950s, perhaps early 60s, of a man-made flying saucer, and there's a guy standing beside it, and they talk about how in 1954 there was a lot of research going into this business of electrogravitics and trying to overcome gravity in one way or another. It's quite an interesting article. So Smith certainly wasn't alone in that regard. And another magazine called Canadian Aviation actually published a rather extensive article on various anti-gravity bits of work that were ongoing. This was back in July of 1959. They called the title of the article was The Key to Travel in Space. And they went into quite a lot of discussion about anti-gravity type methods of propulsion. So Smith certainly wasn't alone in that front. So where did that research go?
Well, yeah, exactly. all of this work that and Smith just didn't spend 6 months working on this.
No.
I mean, over what period of time did he?
Well, from 19. Research? It looks like it was at least from 1949, 1950, right through until 1962 when he passed away.
12 years.
He spent 12 years researching, investigating. A lot of it was spent investigating incidents themselves,
mm-hmm.
People that had seen these things. He spent a fair bit of effort and time looking into it.
Did he ever confide anything of value? I'm sure everything that he did was of value, but did he pass any information on to his family?
Well, the information that he passed on, other than the stuff with Sarbacher, he did say, and he had a lot of comings and goings with the in the United States. He knew a lot of people down there, military and whatnot. He told his son that he had actually been shown alien bodies. I can't tell you when that occurred, during which particular trip he was shown this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the reasons why. It might have happened in the early days when he got the information from Sarbacher that they were real and they wanted him to assist in the investigations. But that's a bit of interesting information that we still need to try and track down.
This is his son, Jim?
This is son, Jim. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
You saw alien bodies?
Yes.
This sounds like the Jackie Gleason story, doesn't it?
It does. That's right.
Jackie Gleason was, as many of our listeners may or may not know, was really into flying saucers, UFOs, and the story goes that he and Richard Nixon played golf together. Richard Nixon played hooky from the White House one night, picked Jackie Gleason up, took him to an Air Force base somewhere, and showed him alien bodies.
Very, very interesting.
Very strange day.
We know that, one of Smith's contacts was Rear Admiral Knowles, who I believe was involved with the Office of Naval Intelligence at the time,
mm-hmm.
and would certainly have had access to that kind of information. Now, whether he was a conduit for that information to Smith or not, I'm not certain of. But Smith certainly had those kinds of contacts down there.
Yeah, not bad for a radio engineer.
Yes. Well, he was regarded internationally for the work he was doing in radio engineering, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Attended many of the discussions with other scientists, and he said that at times they would discuss these issues and that there was a lot of interest among the other scientists.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, among scientists, there probably is, but they're not about to step outside
that
group of people and say anything about it at all.
That's right. I mean, Salant himself told me when I interviewed him about a year before he passed away that he and Vannevar Bush talked about UFOs at length many times over, would never admit to me whether or not Bush gave him good information or not, but it was certainly a topic that they had a mutual interest in.
Henry's been waiting a few minutes on 872-1010. Henry, hang on a couple more moments. We'll take a break here. We'll come back with your call and Palmero Campania on these strange days indeed as we creep ever closer to April Fool's, and I wonder what pranks will come our way. Henry has been dying to get an edge in word ways here. Henry, welcome back to CFRB.
How you doing? Great show, guys.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, you work for the National Defense Department?
That's correct, yeah.
How do your colleagues and your superiors feel about this? I would suspect that they are very uncomfortable and suspicious of you.
Not at all, actually. In fact, most of the information that I get is through the National Archives. I go after documents, and I file the same access request as everybody else does. And I would hazard a guess that my superiors would prefer to see me doing research in the archives than getting into trouble in some other fashion. So they don't have any problem with it at all. The material that I get is properly declassified, and they're the ones that declassify it. So it's not it's really not an issue. And it's very clear in the books that the opinions being expressed are those of myself and not those of the department. I am not speaking in an official capacity on behalf of the department. So as long as that's made very clear, then they really couldn't care less, as far as I can determine so far.
Gentlemen, can I make another point?
Yes.
You know, I've heard this whole show tonight, and, you know, Dave Frelott and everybody, you know, we're never going to get a kind of disclosure about this, because as long as UFOs are, you know, abducting a few people and mutilating a few cattle, there's really no threat. I mean, the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Canadians, they're on their guard and you know, ready for action, but they're not going to disclose this, because, you know, what's going to happen is, you know, well, maybe these aliens have a cure for cancer. Maybe we should make contact.
Hmm. I think what's going to happen, Henry, is that a group of Canadian researchers and seriously interested individuals over the next few months are going to get together and put a package together which will contain the best Canadian UFO evidence, and that'll be presented to all, I think it's 110 members of Parliament.
Okay.
And we will tell them what we know and suggest that in the not-too-distant future would be a good time to have an open public commission of inquiry into all of this.
Well, I look forward to that. Because,
so do I.
Because I am really tired of having read all these books and magazines, and, you know, the government just, you know, seems indifferent.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that we're going to address, and the way that Steve Bassett and Greer and Gersten down in the States are going about it is a very sort of confrontational, very, very in-your-face kind of way of doing it, and that ain't the Canadian way. And we're going to be very nice and very polite, and see if, because if the government knows anything, they're not about to tell us, because they haven't told us for all these years, and it ain't necessarily the government that knows.
But I mean, there's so much at stake. I mean, you know, like our whole concept of nation states and ethnicity, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll just have to wait and see how it goes, Henry. Keep your fingers, eyes, ears, and nose crossed.
Okay, my friend.
Thank you for your call. Good night. Yeah, Henry's a regular here. He started out as just a rank skeptic when we started out 126 shows ago. It was amazing. Yeah, he's swung around a whole 180 degrees.
Good.
Palmiro,
yes.
We've got a couple more callers here.
Yes.
Michel Deschamps, I don't know if you're familiar with Michel's name.
Yes.
MUFON Ontario, he's up there in Sudbury.
He's
on the 1-800 line. He always manages to get in.
Right.
And I know he has a question he's dying to ask you. Michel!
Hi, Errol. Hi, Palmiro.
Yes, hi.
Real quick, I seen you on a documentary, must be a few years back. I wanted to know if you were still of the same opinion that there is still a possibility that what Stephen Mikolak had witnessed in 1967 was still the Avril car or some slight variation of it, or did you completely do a 180 degree on that and say that because of the technological aspects that he described of this object, which did not coincide with our own man-made devices, have you changed your mind?
First of all, I didn't say that what he saw was the Avril car. I used the Avril car as a description because that was a device that we had built. But that his description of what he saw, to me, was that of a very terrestrial device. Mm-hmm. He talked of burning electrical wiring smells. He talked of being burned by a blast of hot air. He talked of, in fact, he touched the side of the craft. This is an object that landed in front of him. Which he approached, and the reason he approached it was because he himself, in the interviews he gave, believed that it was a man-made object. He heard voices inside, which he described to the investigators as human-sounding voices. He couldn't make out what they were saying, but he said they were human-sounding voices. None of this mental telepathy or anything else that goes on in some of the other UFO reports. He approached the object, and he touched the side. Now, it's always been said that he touched the side, and he was wearing a prospector's mitt, some sort of plasticized material, which melted. And that I've always wondered about that, you know, while this thing was very hot. But in fact, in reading the transcripts that I was able to get declassified from the RCMP, what he told him was that when he approached the object, it turned, and he was facing this grillwork pattern arrangement, which is from where the blast of hot air finally came out that burned him when the thing took off. And what he touched was beside the grillwork. So I would expect that part of the craft to be hot. It's no different than a tailpipe. Drive around for a while and then grab that. So no, everything that he talked about with this sighting to me was very terrestrial. I mean, apart from the fact that one of the objects, there were two of them, one hovered for a short period of time, that was it. Even when they took off, their flight path was more of a direct line. There was none of the zigzagging or falling leaf effects or any of the other things that I recall seeing in other UFO reports. Now, did we have hover technology in 1967 when the incident occurred? Yes, we did, in varying degrees. The prototypes of the Harrier aircraft had flown in Britain back in 1961. The Harrier itself, I think, went into production in 66 or thereabouts. We don't know what the U.S. was doing in terms of that type of hover technology. But I'll add one other thing. So you might say, well, if they had this technology, then why don't we see more circular wing aircraft flying around? When you think of circular wing aircraft, you also have to consider, can they carry the payload that's required? Are they true? Do they really have a military value to them? And if they don't, then you're not going to exploit that technology necessarily, or at least with the conventional means available, it might not be feasible. It may become feasible at a later point in time. So did Mikolak see a prototype of something like that? I don't know, but his description certainly sounds to me as terrestrial and not extraterrestrial.
Mm. Okay, Michel.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Take care.
François, à la prochaine. Good night, Michel. Yes.
Very interesting case, that one.
Really intriguing, and it's another one of those that we'll never get to the bottom of.
Well,
we've got as much out of it, I think, as is possible now. I mean, without, you know,
yes.
Just going back and digging, unless you come up with something startling that you and completely unexpected.
Mm. Well, it could always happen.
Yeah, well, it's been known to happen in the past. We're almost at the end of our hour. Would you care to hang in for 10 or 15 more minutes? I'd like to bring Victor Vigiani in after the news at the top of the hour here.
Yes.
Joining us now, along with Palmiro, is Victor Vigiani. Those of you who listen to this program will know that Victor is a regular columnist here. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology and psychology, and until recently was a school principal in the Toronto area. And he took early, and he's just having himself a fine old time now. Welcome back, Victor.
Good evening, everyone. Palmero, good evening.
Hi.
Before we go any further, gentlemen, I want to give Gary a break here. He's been waiting very patiently for a while. Gary, welcome to These Strange Days Indeed on News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010.
Yeah. Palmero.
Yes.
Did you ever hear the Dew Line in the across Canada?
Yes.
Now, you know, we had to, any time we crossed it, flew across it, we had to report in. It was a radar system. Is that correct?
Yes.
Was anything ever detected across that line?
There are a number of sightings that were detected, and there are a number of radar signatures indicating strange phenomena. Some of the reports go back to late 1950s. I'm trying to think of a couple off the top, but I can't at the moment. But okay. Yes, there were a few that were definitely reported.
But wasn't that to detect mostly, it was a Russian threat, it was so thorough, I couldn't cross that line.
Yes.
I couldn't fly across that line without being detected.
That's right. The threat.
But yet they missed it?
Sorry?
Huh?
Yet they missed what, Gary?
No, they did.
UFOs.
No, they did make some detections. They did. They did detect some unidentified flying objects.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Gary. Well,
They're there. They just couldn't report on them publicly, but they definitely detected them.
And we're talking about Dew Line.
Yes.
Dew Line. That was mostly it was mostly U.S. personnel up there.
Well, it was a U.S. Joint U.S.-Canadian radar net.
But all of those reports would have gone to the Pentagon rather than to Ottawa. Yes.
Yes. The early warning system. The reports that I've seen. In fact, there's a website. Where some of those reports are listed, actually it's about it was the Pine Tree line as well, Pine Tree Dew line, and you'll find some reports there that were reported by the Canadians who were stationed there that saw these strange blips on their radar screen.
Yeah, are we talking pinetree.com?
That might be the
website.
One.
Yeah, I have a vague sort of memory of it from a couple of years back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few. There's a few there.
Mm-hmm.
So they did have some detections. But, as you say, the reports, the extensive reports of those, is anybody's guess where they ended up, other than the U.S.
Mm.
I haven't seen any.
In a vault somewhere, probably.
Somewhere down there, probably.
Yeah. Or like the Roswell Army Air Force Base records, they were all destroyed. Unauthorized destruction.
May have been. NORAD collects, obviously, those reports, and we talked about the Falcon Bridge sighting last couple of weeks ago, where the NORAD people there picked up the UFO. Mm. That's quite a good one. Visual corroboration along with the instrument corroboration.
Mm. What do they call? They don't call them skywalkers. What is it?
Fast walkers.
Fast walkers. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
And they do that very fast. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so they even have a code name for them, so that's kind of interesting, too.
Mm. Yes, yeah. And then we talked about the joint agreements between Canada and the U.S. For the reporting of unidentified flying objects, the GENAP orders, and followed by national defense instructions, internal instructions for the reporting of UFOs. There was a poster that was published in the 1959. Which showed the pictorials of various things to be reported, one of which was a circular flying saucer.
Mm. Do you have a copy of that poster?
It's in the book, yeah.
It's in the book?
Yes. Copy is in the book. You see all three of the pictorials, and it tells you where to send your report and all the rest of it. And those are the ones that they're still sending reports in accordance with some of the formats that were developed back then.
Mm. And what happens to those reports?
Well, that's a good question. At the moment, it sounds like, from my way of thinking, if there are any credible reports, they go down to NORAD. Mm-hmm. If they are the typical circular whatever, but nothing distinguishable. Nothing further is done with them.
Mm.
And as I understand, I think Chris Rutkowski is starting to receive some of those.
Yeah, I was wondering if Chris was the official reporting. Suddenly become Canada's official reporting center.
Yeah, National Research Council used to collect those.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see those records there at the archives.
Yes.
Under the NRC files. But they stopped doing that a few years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a problem because people don't know who to contact anymore, other than the private groups like MUFON or, you know, Chris and the folks out in BC.
BC, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit unfortunate in that respect that the government has just kind of said, well, forget it.
Mm. Well, it costs money, and everybody's on cutbacks. Although there was a major somewhere in Ottawa who has a... Was it Chris who was telling us that last year? Mm-hmm. Who has a small office somewhere, you know, at defense headquarters, and has file cabinets full of UFO reports.
Well, there could be somebody that still... I mean, people still call the department.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't hang up on you for, you know, by any stretch, but they'll probably make a note of the thing, and it's true, it might just get put into a filing cabinet, and that's about the end of it.
Mm.
Unless it's something interesting, in which case I think it goes down into the NORAD group.
I'd like to take just a couple more moments of your time and perhaps discuss this this project that still doesn't have a name that all of us are working on. Let's break here. Come back, and a couple of moments we'll spend talking about that with Palmiro Campagna, and Victor Vigiani is on the line with us. And after the 12:30 news, the UFO watchdog will join us here on News Talk Radio, CFRB 1010.
We've all heard them. Some songs that are pretty awful. The Too High Taxes Blues. The Too Much Overhead Polka. The I Can't Afford to Do Business Here opera.
Oh no.
Yuck. You'd probably like to be whistling a different tune. One that's catchy.
The city above Toronto.
One that's got a good beat.
The city above Toronto.
One that's easy to do business to.
The city above Toronto, the city of Vaughan.
While others may be singing the blues about high taxes and raising taxes, the city of Vaughan is doing something that'll be music to your ears. Vaughan is keeping taxes low. Vaughan, a tax. One of the reasons the city of Vaughan has been named one of the 5 best cities in Canada by Globe and Mail's Report on Business. To find out more and be taxed less, call the award-winning Vaughan Economic Development Team at 905-832-8521. 905-832-8521. Vaughan. More music, less tax.
I'm here with skater Ben Ferreira, one of Canada's best. Ben, I see you wear a Medic Alert bracelet.
Yeah, I've had asthma since I was a kid.
You've competed in the World Championships, so apparently it doesn't slow you down.
That's true. I skate all over the world, and Medic Alert protects me everywhere, with 24-hour access to my emergency medical information. That lets me breathe easier, so I can focus on my skating.
Medic Alert. Around your wrist, around the clock, around the world. It's always on call. For information, call 1-800-668-1507.
Strange Days Indeed is the name of the program. With us, Palmiro Campagna on the line from Ottawa, and a regular contributor to this program, Victor Vigiani.
Can I make one last comment there about the radar?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very quickly, it's interesting, you know, the caller was concerned that these things hadn't been, or thought that they hadn't been picked up or recorded. I don't know if you're familiar with the name Peter Millman.
Yes.
Who was the the debunker
right.
of UFOs.
Yes.
And in his maxims, one of his maxims was that instruments can deceive, and he goes at length to try and explain why the radars that did pick things up weren't picking up UFOs. So on the one hand, you know, you have the one fellow who thinks that they weren't being picked up, when in fact they were in some instances and being reported, Millman going out of his way to try and prove that the radar was incorrect.
Yeah, we need to get into Peter Millman one day. Chris yeah. sent me this very funny clump of facts on Millman to use on the program, Best Canadian UFO Cases, a couple of weeks back. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we just never got to it. So the next time we have you back, maybe we can get into a little bit of that. That would be interesting. I want to take a couple of moments and just discuss this upcoming project that we're looking for a name for. I guess you both read what's various members of the group that seems to be forming have sent back and forth. I think pretty much covered it off earlier on, but any further ideas from either of you two gentlemen live on the radio? You're on the spot.
On the spot, right. If I could just inject a word here, Errol.
Yeah.
The whole initiative, to me, is absolutely critical. There's no doubt in my mind that if the foundational aspects of what we're doing approach sort of a critical mass, I think we have to come to an understanding that eventually this is going to have to get to the man on the street or the person on the street. We do have to confront, not a good word, but we do have to provide our members of parliament with the best possible evidence that we have available. And from that, what we have to do is somehow provide the people with information that is something different than what the media would definitely give us as the fodder to chew on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And as long as we keep on assuming that people are going to get their information from television and all the misconceptions that come from that, I think that the project just perhaps may be doomed to failure. In one sense, I do think we need to depend on the media, but in another way, it could be our own providential poison in some way. And I'm not sure exactly how the media has to be brought into this. Mm. But the average person on the street, you know, they're going to work every day. They're paying their mortgages. They're raising their kids, and they're just involved in the day-to-day aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to get these individuals to turn around and look at the issue in a realistic form? Now, if we can get the screaming and yelling that's going on in the Commons right now, I don't know if you've heard of any of it lately on the airwaves, but in terms of what the Prime Minister's going through, if we can get the screaming and the yelling in the Commons going on in some format to discuss what's going on in our skies, perhaps we just might get somewhere. Now, that could be a false hope in one way. But I think the initiative has to be brought to the forefront by providing the members of our parliament with the best possible evidence that we can possibly muster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how we do that, I think that's for our group to discover. And I think bringing it to the forefront is our first concern, and not having them deal with it with the giggle factor that the media might attribute to it. I'm not sure how Palmer responds to that, and even the other individuals that may be listening right now by their crystal sets, but I think that's the crux of the matter.
Yeah.
No, I tend to agree there as well. I guess in one of the comments that I sent in, I was simply issuing a bit of a caution as well, in the sense that people are going on with their day-to-day lives, politicians included. I'm not so sure that the subject of UFOs and extraterrestrials is high on their priority, so we have to be very careful on how we approach, how the approach is made, so that we don't come off looking like another fringe group or something.
Yeah, a bunch of saucer heads, tinfoil hat wearers, yeah.
Yeah, we got to be careful there.
Mm-hmm.
And, but otherwise, you're quite right. Something needs to be assembled. I think the best cases need to be looked at in terms of the evidence that's there and presentations made.
Yeah. And I think that will happen. we have a few months to put it together. I think probably that the way it's being discussed at the moment is putting a CD together. Probably recordings from this program, contributions by various researchers across the country, along with with an announcer voice on it and facts and stats on there, and some printed support material, and then mail that to each one of the MPs in Ottawa for their edification and for their consideration, and then follow up with phone calls and get them on this program.
That's right.
and get their input.
Precisely. Just by way of information, about a month ago, I took an initiative to email several individuals in the cabinet, and even pardon my intrusion in this, but the member of parliament that is the honorable member for the that represents the opposition in parliament, and I got an absolute flat response from his executive assistant. I got a little bit of an inquiry, but as long as I didn't mention the U word or the D word, they were interested in presuming that what I had to say was of interest.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I mentioned anything to do with extraterrestrial or UFOs or whatever,
mm-hmm.
the door automatically shut.
Yeah, I think that's a reflex action more than anything else.
Yes. What does that represent, I guess, is my question. Is it just an absolute, you know, as a just absolute closure right to begin with, or is it just an attitude that politicians just aren't able to deal with such a polemical idea?
That's probably what it is, and it's a political answer. They don't know who they're being tested by.
Yeah, and will there be gravy coming from it?
Mm.
I guess on the other side of it too, they'll probably ask the same question that's been asked: what do you expect would come out of a scientific study of the subject, or what do you know, what do you expect them to have hidden in their files?
Well, we're not asking them to reveal anything.
No, so
what we like is to let them know what we know, suggest that based on that evidence, I mean, it's certainly enough to get people hung in a court of law, you know, based on that evidence, to have a public
inquiry,
inquiry into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a very small, Errol. I don't know how much longer we have to go before the break at 12:30. But
yeah.
I just and wonder what, just as a mentioning kind of point of view. Palmer, are you familiar at all with Project 1794? Does that mean anything to you?
The name rings a bell for some
reason. Okay, it's the final development summary.
Yes.
That was developed by the United States Air Force as a contract number.
Yes.
The Avro aircraft.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that report was generated by Frost and by H.C. Moody.
Okay.
And now at the time, it was in 1956. Now the only reason I'm mentioning this.
Yes.
Is why would the United States government ask Avro Canada at that time to develop a saucer craft, a VTOL saucer craft with radial engines on it in a circular format? Why would the United States Air Force ask the Canadian government to develop a craft that could move to Mach 3 and Mach 4 at that time? Now, I'm not asking you to put you on the spot about that. It's a rhetorical question in the sense that what business did the United States government back in 1956 have in approaching the Canadian government, or even Avro Aircraft,
in
developing such a craft?
In fact, Dr. Soland figures prominently into that again. Frost wanted to develop this device because he'd heard of the German, alleged German developments, and thought he could do it. The U.S. had already asked their own air forces, air suppliers, air manufacturers, to look into this, and Frost, through Soland, was able to convince the folks down there that his design would be the most viable one, and they bought into it, and they gave him a contract to start work on it,
to pursue it.
Oh yeah, yeah. In fact, I cover the whole thing in some detail in my book, and I'm just looking at it now. Project 1794
mm-hmm.
was it was also called Weapon System 606A and VZ9AV.
Mm-hmm.
But it was through the Dr. Soland that the connections were made with the Americans, and Frost went down there to the Pentagon, briefed the folks down there, and they decided to give him the contract. The whole idea of it was vertical takeoff. You don't need runways.
That's right, yeah.
So you can hide in forests, you can land just about anywhere and not be seen. That was the idea.
I guess my point is, it's the crack in the wall in terms of how the government, our government back then, tried to pursue something that had to do with, quote-unquote, an extraterrestrial influence that the United States government may be trying to ascertain the possibilities of.
Yes.
And that's the only reason that I bring it up.
Right.
The project itself probably, you know, it died on the firing line, I guess.
Mm. Well, the Avro car itself kind of did, but as I said, there were other circular projects and electrogravitics and that maybe didn't die.
That's right, and I guess that's where I'd like to go with it.
Yeah, me too.
So what does the government know about it?
Yeah. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Thank you both. Victor, apologies for it being so short. Palmiro, thank you very much. A really good 90 minutes from you. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Good evening, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Good night, gentlemen. Thanks a lot. Joining us on this program right now is Royce J. Myers III. he has an interesting website, UFO Hall of Frauds, Dirtbags, Dupes, and Morons. The UFO Watchdog, Royce J. Myers. He has an educational occupational background in law enforcement and criminalistics forensics. He first became interested in UFOs in March of 1994, having had a sighting in Oregon. He's been working in conjunction with BLT Research. He's conducted field investigations into crop phenomena and cattle mutes. He's the editor of Exposé, the watchdog of ufology. And, well, the new website is UFOWatchdog.com. Royce, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Oh, this April 1st?
Okay, I have to first say, you have to excuse me if I'm sounding bad. I've been out sick for the last 2 weeks, and I'm just now getting over whatever's going around.
Oh, yeah, there's some fairly ugly stuff been going around, I understand, too. I've been fortunate, touch wood.
I was out of work for 2 weeks.
Mm. Yeah, the thing is, when you do what I do, you really can't afford to be sick at all, you know?
No, especially with your voice, yeah.
It's live radio that has to be done every week, and yeah. So, what you been looking into lately, Watchdog?
Well, there's been a couple of things going on. I've revamped the website a little bit. For those of you that may be listening that used to know the website by Exposé, the Watchdog of Ufology, it's just now called UFOWatchdog.com.
Mm-hmm.
What I've been looking into, and a lot of people out there know I've been looking into this for quite a while now, is the strange case of Jonathan Reed, the man who claimed that he'd killed an alien out in the woods of Washington State after it had disintegrated his dog.
Mm.
And I'd been looking at this hoax for quite a while, and we'll get to why it's a hoax here in a minute.
But he's been speaking publicly on this at all kinds of places, hasn't he?
Right, and that's one of the big problems with this mm-hmm. story, too, is that he's part of his story was that after he'd killed this alien, he'd taken it home, stuffed it in a freezer. It came back to life. He had left his house for some reason. And for lack of a better term, the government thugs were alleged to have shown up and to have ransacked his house and destroyed most of it, taking all of his photographic and video evidence, well, most of it anyway,
mm-hmm.
and then removing this alien, and it was just this big tale, and now he's been on the run, and he's been shot, and he's been beat up, and he's been drugged, and for a guy that is supposed to be in hiding, he apparently isn't that hard to get to.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Philadelphia last Sunday, I believe, the 25th, doing a presentation for a group out there. He's going to go down to San Diego May 6th during this last International UFO Congress conference over in Laughlin, Nevada. He was reported to be kind of just hanging around, checking things out with his friends.
Mm.
So for a guy that's on the run and who's in hiding, he's apparently not that hard to get to.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the big problems with the story. The other problem with the story is that a lot of people that have looked at his evidence, his photographic evidence, and all the claims that he's made, they just fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
He has absolutely not one shred of solid proof to back his story. When this hoax first came out, on behalf of a private party in Canada, I offered him $1 million to come forward with his evidence and to have it evaluated, and that if he could prove his claim, he'd walk away with $1 million. And no one in the Reed camp ever had stepped up to accept that offer at all.
Mm. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Better making $200 or $300 in speaking engagements than $1 million proving it.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so here's a guy that has a website. He's got a book published. He's been on a nationally syndicated radio program with millions of listeners several times. He's able to stay on the phone for hours at a time. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, but most of the stuff on that nationally syndicated radio show is a bunch of old crap.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely agree with you. and why any serious ufologist or anybody who has a serious interest in UFOs who's out there doing investigations and whatever else would ever be on that program. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and trash another radio personality on your show.
Well, we don't mention any names, but most people would know who we're talking about.
Right. Would want to associate themselves and their reputation and their credibility with that show is beyond me. I've just never understood that. And perhaps, you know, it's only one of the few big media outlets that they have access to, so maybe that's the reason. But aside from that, there's just this Jonathan Reed story, just it falls apart and falls apart and falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
Just some specific examples. There was a picture of him that was showing he had claimed that he was the victim of a botched kidnapping where he had been shot with a 9mm handgun. Well, there's a photo of this alleged bullet wound, and it's just, it's a joke.
Mm.
I mean, anybody looking at it, you know, if you've ever seen real gunshot wounds, you know, you can tell the real deal from a makeup job, and that's exactly what it is. And apparently while he was down at Laughlin, Nevada last year as the keynote speaker, by the way, for the International UFO Congress, I don't know why they did that, he was approached by, I believe, Dr. Lear and Lloyd Pye, and they asked to see his bullet wound. And apparently Reed turned tail and ran from them.
Mm.
He didn't want to be anywhere near them. The other problems with the story is, you know, he claimed that he worked at the University of Washington as a research psychologist. He claimed that he had been at Johns Hopkins University working with the prestigious Dr. Frank Oskey. Well, his claim with working with Dr. Oskey is completely fabricated because he said he worked with him in 1979, but Dr. Oskey didn't arrive there until 1985.
Ooh.
I've been in touch, right, a small timeline error there, huh? Six
yeah.
years. I've been in touch with the people in up in Washington State, the University of Washington,
mm-hmm.
and they've done checks on this guy, and they're just like, we've never heard of him.
Yeah.
And they don't employ self-employed, you know, research psychologists on contract at the university. You have to be a faculty member in order to have that status there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And there's just a number, you know, no one can find this guy's dissertation. He's supposed to have a Ph.D., and it just, the list goes on and on and on. So no one can find out who this guy is, if Jonathan Reed is even his real name, as he claims.
Mm. Well, perhaps, well, I doubt it, though. I was going to say perhaps it'll go away, but, you know, it's like the alien autopsy. It's just going to hang out and hang out. You know?
Right, until someone gets a smoking gun that comes in and just blows it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Reed's story just goes on and on and on. During this whole thing, when he claimed to have this alien at his house, he claimed that he had a friend there with him named Gary and wouldn't say, you know, give the guy's last name or anything else. They claimed to have called Peter Davenport at the National UFO Reporting Center, and they said it was about, I think it was the 17th of October in 96. They said that they had spoken to him fairly anonymously, asking, you know, what-if questions, what if we had a dead alien, this and that. Well, the only problem with that is that Peter Davenport was out of the country. So there's no way they could have ever called him.
Boy, they just don't get anything right.
it gets ridiculous. And it gets more ridiculous as time goes on. These people made another appearance on that on the nationally syndicated radio program,
mm-hmm.
and they brought a guy named Dr. Harold Chacon on saying, yes, I've examined blood and tissue samples from this alleged alien. It's extraterrestrial. But they couldn't provide any proof at all. They couldn't provide any of their scientific findings, no documentation of any analysis they ever did, nothing, no DNA sequencing charts. There was not one iota of proof. And the other problem is that Dr. Harold Chacon claimed that he graduated from the University of Puerto Rico with a degree in microbiology, except they don't offer those degrees, and there's no one named Harold Chacon that's ever gone to that university.
And the beat goes dum, dum, dum. Dumb.
Oh, it gets better.
Royce, I spent an hour or two at your website a week or so ago. You got a lot of... Geez, you've done a lot of work.
It took me a long time to get all the information together.
A lot of good information. I mean, it's not. I mean, it's not particularly good for the people that.
I don't think it is.
That you're nailing to the web, but some good stuff there nonetheless. Yeah. Have we done with Reed?
Oh, I'm not done.
No. I mean, have we done with Reed now, or do you have more to lay on us?
I have just a few more items to lay on you.
Okay, go ahead.
One's really significant, and I want to get to that because I think that this is I know that it's a nail in the coffin for this case.
Mm-hmm.
During this whole ordeal, what's come out is there's a gentleman named Dan Iaria, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who has a website up, aliendestiny.com. And he supports this case and has stated that, yeah, it's true. I believe it 100%. And on this website, and apparently Reed and his cohorts have cooked this story up, that there was a prominent doctor, Dr. Roger Haggett, and then there was a research chemist named Michael Wessels who worked at the University of Washington. Unfortunately, both of them have passed away. Dr. Haggett was the victim of a homicide where an intern who was going to be dismissed from a program apparently that he was overlooking went into Dr. Haggett's office and shot him to death. Michael Wessels, this research chemist, was the unfortunate victim of an outdoor accident. He was scaling a cliff or something to that effect and fell 500 feet to his death. What they've done is they've been plucking names out of the local Seattle paper up there, one of the major papers, and they have named both of these gentlemen as people who were involved with the DNA analysis, the alleged DNA analysis on Reed's bogus alien.
Oh.
And both of these people were victims of very, you know, tragic endings, unfortunately. And for them to do that just goes beyond sick.
And hope that they won't get caught. I mean, they seem to be just totally inept.
Well, exactly. You know, they want to make these claims, and unfortunately, these people aren't here to step up and say, no, I don't know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it gets worse than that. Not only are they dragging the names of two dead people around, they decided to drag a third around. And apparently, Reed had stated this at, and I could be wrong about this, this is secondhand because I wasn't at his presentation in Philadelphia, but apparently he is now alleging that there was a professor that he referred to as Professor X, who was involved with this whole thing.
Mm.
And he's alleging that Professor X, and this is on this Dan Iaria guy's site too, was none other than Dr. Carl Sagan.
What?
Yeah. Is it ridiculous or what? I was shocked to see this information on their websites. I can imagine how the families of these people feel that Reed is now using these people as martyrs to further his con.
You know, you have to wonder if this man is just a total dink.
It's
disgusting. Or is he out? Does he have another agenda?
I was like you. You know, when I first heard it, you know, I could tell you were a little speechless there. What are you supposed to think about something like that? I mean, that's just, as far as I'm concerned, it's totally unacceptable and outlandish that they're doing this.
Yeah.
And I think that anybody who supports this hoax had better take a second look at it. So on from there, I'm tired. I'm done being mad now. For further on this,
I love the stuff on. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
With regard to their hoax, and the reason that I can prove it's a hoax,
mm-hmm,
is in their alien photos, they have several problems. Reed claimed that this outfit that this alien had on was indestructible. He'd cut it with a knife or a razor blade and it had sealed itself back up together. Well, if you look in some of the photos, you can see a straight pin in this alien super garment. You can see a button. And then if you look at the alien itself in several spots, and you can see this on the website, I have a lot of photos that some people were very, very nice that sent me their own analysis of the photos. You can see pins all throughout this alien's head. Well, it gets better than that. I had the good fortune of finding out that, well, Dan Iaria had put on his website that October of 2000 he had visited with Bob Shell, who is the editor of Shutterbug Magazine, and Bob is a recognized expert in the field of photography. He's a photographic consultant. He's testified as an expert witness in federal court.
And spent a lot of time on UFO updates in its early years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan went and took these negatives that Reed has from the very beginning stated, and he has said this several times on this radio program and in person, that these are the actual negatives that I had shot this film on,
uh-huh,
of this alien and this UFO. Well, I already decided to take these to Bob Schell under the guise of having them examined.
Mm-hmm.
Got there, presented the negatives to Schell. Unfortunately, it wasn't an in-depth analysis as to what exactly was on the image, you know, whether there was some manipulation there or strings or whatever else or with the UFO or anything else wrong with the photo of the alien. He presented the negatives in the sense that he wanted Bob Schell to only look at them and say, are these normally exposed negatives?
Mm.
Well, that doesn't prove anything. Big deal. Yeah, okay, fine. It'll eliminate airbrushing techniques and whatever else. That's fine, but it doesn't do anything in depth as far as an analysis goes on looking at his photo of his UFO or whatever else. So I already told him, yes, these are the original negatives. Gave him the Schell. Schell said, okay, fine, they're normal negatives. Well, when I found out about this, I decided to contact Bob Schell and send him an email.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, I did look at the negatives, and they're normal negatives, but I have something of a concern here with regard to when this particular film was produced. So I went and looked at the negatives that are on the website, and all Kodak negatives have a number. They
mm-hmm.
have the three-digit speed, you know, like or the four-digit speed, like
right.
400 speed film.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a dash and then another number.
Right.
Well, that last number on there represents a generation. And the film that Reed has is 800 speed generation 2 Kodak 35mm film, and then another one that's 400 speed 6th generation 35mm Kodak film. Now, this generation number, Kodak keeps these very, very good records of just extensive records on when this film is produced and when it's introduced into market. The 800-2 was went into production. They started making it in November of 96. And it was introduced into market for consumer consumption in January 97. The 400-6, 400 speed film, sixth generation, went to production in November of 96 and was released to consumer consumption for market in 1997, of February.
Okay.
February of 97.
Mm-hmm.
So the film wasn't available until January of 97 and February of 97. Now, Reed says that his UFO encounter took place in October of 96. Well, you can't. It's impossible because the film that he alleges are the original negatives didn't exist in October of 96.
It sounds like this man just cannot get anything right at all.
Well, no. Now, it gets better than that.
We have about 45 seconds.
Okay. I recontacted Bob Schell, and now Reed is claiming through IARIA that there are copies of slides that he took. And Bob Schell looked at him and said, I'm not buying that they're actual copies. So as far as I'm concerned, the film wasn't there. He's tripped on his story again.
Mm.
He's closed.
What's this man's name?
Which?
Reed?
Jonathan Reed.
Jonathan Reed, right.
Jonathan Reed. Yes, and I got an email from someone today claiming that he talked to a roommate of a guy named Robert Wraith, who is the author of Reed's book. He talked to Robert Wraith's roommate, and apparently he's going to be contacting me with a lot of information about these two characters.
I look forward to reading more of it at your website, Royce, www.ufowatchdog.com. Go and have several chuckles to yourself. Go and educate yourself about who you need to know and you don't need to know in this field if you if you want to pursue it and spend a little time. Don't waste your time, right?
Don't waste your money either.
Yes, and as it says right here, don't trip on your open mind. Royce J. Myers III, thank you.
Thank you.
And we will keep up with one another. We'll have you back in a couple, 3 weeks.
Okay.
And we'll catch up with you again. Good website, Royce. Good work.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your work.
Take care.
Try and keep it all honest. Good night. Royce J. Myers III, www.ufowatchdog.com. Yeah, who says we don't police ourselves? Well, somebody has to. There's a lot of just shysters and charlatans out there. I have to bail. That's this week's look at Strange Days Indeed. You can email us anytime. The address is sdi@cfrb.com. Thanks to Graham Elliott out there in the control room. General Graham finger wiggle in your general direction. Strange Days Indeed is copyright of and is co-produced by WT Fit and Random Records. The exec producer is Gene Mascardelli. I'm responsible for putting all this together. I guess that sort of technically makes me the producer. Join us again next week. I'm Errol Bruce Knapp, and this is CFRB 1010. Good night.